lovers, welcome to Get Real, a podcast hosted by the National Animal Interest Alliance, through which we'll have deeply honest conversations about animal research so we can learn together and make compassionate choices about our medical future together. Welcome to episode 27 of Get Real. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real, and today we're going to talk about retiring research monkeys to sanctuaries. It sounds like a perfect plan, doesn't it? Surely a sanctuary would be the ideal place for our monkeys to spend the rest of their lives, wouldn't it? Scott Kubisch, director and founder of Peaceable Primate Sanctuary, will lay out the facts for us today on Get Real. Thanks for joining us on Get Real today, Scott. I know you're a really busy guy, and I appreciate you giving up some time on a Friday evening to chat with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Cindy. I'm definitely looking forward to talking about retirement here.
Right. What we're going to talk about today is, you know, what happens to research animals when the studies are over, right? We don't hear a lot about that. And let's start with the basic facts, because I think it's really important for everyone to know the actual facts about everything when it comes to research with animals. And the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of the animals in research are euthanized. And the reason for that is that the answers we're looking for are in their tissues. Now, for those of us who work with these animals closely, and we've discussed the lab animal folks who love these animals so much, and I'm among them, this is a very difficult part of what we do. You know, we get bonded with these animals, and then our hearts are broken, and we sign up for that over and over and over again because we understand the good that comes from this work for animals and people. But nevertheless, losing animals all the time is very hard. There are times, however, when animals don't have to be euthanized, depending on the nature of the study. And in those cases, we can try to find those animals' homes, and we live for those moments. Now, one of the tricks here is that grant funding doesn't provide any money for this. As far as the government's concerned, you know, when the study ends, the money ends. And so it's difficult for us to find the resources we need to find our animals that can be retired homes. And it's especially difficult for us to do this with animals that we can't bring to our house, you know, like monkeys, for example, animals that require long-term care and also special handling because they're wild animals. In those cases, we look to sanctuaries to help us out. And I've invited you today because you have what is, in my opinion, the absolutely best old world monkey retirement sanctuary in the nation. And so I thought it would be really interesting for our listeners to hear more about this. They don't know a lot about monkeys, and they certainly don't know much about sanctuaries. And having been to your place myself directly multiple times, I'm really excited about what it is you're going to share with them. So let's start with your background. What inspired you to start Peaceable Primates?
So my background is mainly from the zoological field. Back in the late 80s, I started at Brookfield Zoo and started working with domestic farm animals, training horses, doing things like that, and then kind of worked my way up to various exotic species as well, primates included, big cats. After about 5 years, I went to Lincoln Park Zoo for 22 years and then continued my career working with all different species of exotic animals, just not primates, again, big cats, seals, birds, reptiles, you name it, I probably took care of it. During that time when I was at Lincoln Park Zoo, I started doing some research and just by chance came across a video of a baboon in a lab cage at a university and was curious on what happened to that primate once those studies were done. As I started researching it more, I saw that there were mainly either passed on to other studies or they were, again, euthanized, like you had talked about earlier. So again, starting doing some research, was put in contact with Dr. Linda Brent from Chimp Haven, started talking to her, and kind of came up with the concept of starting a primate sanctuary. So at that time, the big movement was more for chimpanzees and starting sanctuaries for chimpanzees to be retired. But as I was talking to her, found out that there were some other chimp sanctuaries that were getting developed, and she wasn't really sure that there was going to be much more of a need for more chimp sanctuaries. So she asked me what other primates I had taken care of throughout my career. And I told her I always had a love for baboons and was really interested in baboons. And she basically said, why not start a baboon sanctuary? And I said, okay, I will. And the baboons kind of carried on to the macaque part of it. So now we offer sanctuary to baboons and macaques.
For our listeners, macaques are rhesus monkeys, crab-eating macaques, right? The long-tailed macaques that we're reading about, the cynomolgus monkeys. These are the monkeys that are most common in research. They're referred to as old world monkeys. I know you love baboons. Why do you love baboons so much?
I think the thing that drew me to baboons the most was the time that I was able to spend with them and really see their dedication to one another, how loyal the males are to the females and how loyal the females are to each other and also to their infants. And their social structure in general really intrigued me and forced me in a way to just learn more about them and how they do function on a daily basis. And the more I learned, the more I loved them.
Mm-hmm. And so at the time, was there a sanctuary prepared and trained to care for research baboons?
From what I know of, there were some other sanctuaries that had baboons, some from the pet trade, some from research. There really wasn't any sanctuary that was set up to take bigger groups of baboons. So we thought that that's where the need was. We felt that if it was just maybe one or two, the other sanctuaries could absorb those individual animals into their sanctuary. But if there was ever a university or a pharmaceutical company that had a need for a larger group of animals, there weren't many sanctuaries, if any, that would be able to handle that situation.
So I'm assuming then that you did identify universities or other folks that did research with baboons in particular that wanted to work with you and find their baboons' homes after study. Is that right?
We did find some universities that did have baboons. And the first retirees that we accepted at the sanctuary were three baboons from Yale. Yale had contacted us and asked if we would accept three female baboons, which we agreed to. And then it just kind of snowballed from there.
Okay, so you love baboons. You really want to provide opportunities for retirement for baboons in research whenever possible. When did you start the sanctuary and how did you get started? Like you had to get land? I mean, tell us that story.
The whole process started probably almost 25 years ago. I was in my 30s when I started. I'm now in my 50s. So when we originally started, we had just started our nonprofit and our organization. We didn't have any funding from the nonprofit side. So I purchased the land with my retirement fund that I had set up from the zoo, started making the payments on the property. And then when the sanctuary was financially able to take on the payments and the maintenance of the property, I signed it over to the sanctuary. The whole process from the idea to when we actually started accepting primates at the sanctuary, which was 8 years ago, there was about 15 to 17 years in between when we started to when we actually opened up and started accepting the primates.
Wow. You actually have been planning the sanctuary and the creation of the sanctuary longer than you've actually had animals in the sanctuary. So in the past 7 or 8 years that you've had animals actively, things have developed very rapidly. Tell us what was there in the beginning when your first three came, where you are now, including how many animals you have at this point.
When we started, we accepted our first three baboons. Then every year, 2 to 5 would come in. And really, in the last 3 years, we've had a larger influx of primates into the sanctuary. So when we bought the property, there was nothing there. It was a dirt road and a cornfield. So there was no electricity. There was no water. There were no buildings, nothing. Currently, we have our food prep area. We have an office for our office staff. We have 5 animal buildings currently on the property, with another one being constructed next month. Probably by the end of the year, it should be completed. And then we have started construction on our animal clinic, which should be done in the next few months. So we've grown quite a lot in the 8 years. And our current census is 73 primates that we have on the sanctuary grounds.
73 primates. So break them down for me. How many are baboons? How many are rhesus macaques? How many are long-tailed macaques? How many are crab-eating macaques?
The smallest amount right now, believe it or not, are baboons. When we started and thinking of the concept of having a baboon sanctuary, we thought there was going to be a much bigger need for baboons, but it's turned out there's been a much bigger need for macaques. So I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the majority of our animals are rhesus macaques. The next would be long-tailed macaques and then baboons after that.
Yeah, and that makes sense because those are the primary monkeys that are involved in research at this point in time, the macaques. They're super important for so many reasons. And I'm just excited that more and more people are retiring them and that they have a wonderful place to retire them too. So let's talk a little bit about the needs of these animals. Very few people really understand much about old world monkeys and the needs they have, right? So they have, you know, obviously very specific health and physical needs, but they have social needs. They have behavioral needs. They can also be dangerous. These are complicated animals to maintain because we have to address all of these needs of theirs in a research setting. So take us through how you prepare your staff to address all of those needs. I think that would be interesting for our listeners to hear about.
From the construction side of it, with housing old world primates, things have to be built rather strong. They have to be able to contain them. They are wild animals. They still need to be in an enclosure for their safety and also for the safety of the general public. So you can't just throw something together. So we do pretty extensive indoor and outdoor caging. The outside caging is buried into the ground to stop them if they attempted to dig out. There's all these other things that need to be taken into consideration when you're housing really any exotic animal, but primates specifically. I always explain it to people like this. That primate has 24 hours a day to try to figure out what they can break, what they can pull apart, or how they could potentially escape. So I always tell our staff, think of it from the animal side of it. They're in this enclosure for 24 hours a day. They expect everything from us, which is a clean environment, something to entertain their mind and their body, good food, friends to socialize with, good interactions with the individuals that are caring for them. It's our responsibility to make sure that they have all of that. The one thing that I would say is the most important to our staff is social interaction. They want to be with their own kind, and we go above and beyond to make sure that everybody has a partner or a friend or multiple friends that they can sit with and groom each other and socialize and play and forage for food and sleep together and rest together and do all those things that they should be doing. So I emphasize that to our staff to make sure that we're really looking at everything that we do on a daily basis from the primate's perspective. We should be thinking of what more can we do for better enrichment, for toys that they can play with? What can we do better to pair them with another individual? Just like human beings, they don't like every monkey that they meet. You don't like everybody that you meet. You have to find that right person that you're drawn to. Monkeys are the exact same way. So at the sanctuary for staff, we go through continuing education. We're always encouraging our staff to learn more and to look at things a different way and to talk to other individuals that maybe have more experience. If we bring somebody in that doesn't have a lot of experience, we hook them up with somebody that's been there for a period of time so that they can work closely with that individual to learn all these different ways of properly caring for our animals. The other thing that I'm a big advocate for is medical care. Unfortunately, a lot of sanctuaries don't always provide great medical care for their retirees. Again, they rely on us for everything. So the least that we can do is give them proper medical care. So that's annual physicals, dental checkups, annual blood work, a healthy, balanced diet, all those things that a human would need or expect or demand, we make sure that our retirees have that as well.
Right. And so that requires you to work with some veterinarians, and they have to have expertise in these kinds of animals. So tell us about your veterinarians.
We work with several different veterinarians. Our primary veterinarian right now is Dr. Iris Bolton, and she's worked at several different facilities throughout the country with primates and various other species. We also consult with Dr. Lisa Halliday, and then we also have local veterinarians that we work with, which may not necessarily have primate experience. They would be more dog, cat, farm animals, livestock, but they can still assist us if we need their assistance. So we work with them as well. And then luckily, all the facilities that we work with for retirement have always gone above and beyond to offer any assistance that we would need from the veterinarian side or just consulting, which really, really helps us.
Yeah. I mean, it would be difficult to find veterinarians outside of the research / lab animal field. I mean, unless they're in zoos, veterinarians don't typically work with this kind of monkey. So the fact that the lab animal community steps up like that for you is, I think, a very genuine reflection of their love and care for these animals. They really do matter to us. And so I love hearing that. Now, you said cages before. Maybe you can describe, you know, a typical indoor-outdoor setup for a group of your macaques.
So our inside buildings for all of our primates, they have shelves to sit on and fire hose to hang from and things to play with and barrels and different toys. They all have windows to look outside. So if it's not a very nice day outside, they can still sit up on a shelf and still look outside the window. One thing that is really, really good about some of the buildings that we do is they all have in-floor heating, which I think is great for the monkeys. The monkeys love the in-floor heating. They love to lay on the floor. And just like human beings, if you've ever walked on in-floor heating, it's quite comfortable and quite soothing to you. So the monkeys get the same from the in-floor heating that they have. And then their outside enclosures can go anywhere from an area that's maybe 2,000 square feet, and they go up to a quarter of an acre in size for some of our bigger baboon troops. So they have grass outside, and they have things to climb on, and again, things to play, and they can dig in the dirt and eat the grass and forage for bugs and grains and watch the birds and do all those other things. So they have pretty extensive outdoor areas as well.
Yeah, and I've seen them. It's very impressive. You even have solar panels set up to power some of this. The whole place is just incredible. And if anybody is anywhere near Indiana, and I'll provide the website for your sanctuary in the episode response page for this episode at the end so folks can learn more about you. You do host events so people can meet the monkeys, and I encourage everyone to go check it out. So let's talk a little bit more about the folks who work there. So you have people that you train as husbandry people. You have people who are trained to put together their diets and measure out how much they should have and monitor all of that. And you have some specially trained vet technicians as well. And all of these people communicate with you as the person who runs the show and the operation, but also with these veterinarians you spoke with, right, who are very well versed in the needs of monkeys, right? Tell us a little bit about those people and how they get their training and what's a typical day look like in the sanctuary.
We do have different levels for our care staff that come in. So if they come in with a minimal amount of knowledge in regards to taking care of exotic animals, they're paired with a caretaker that has been there for a longer period of time and work very closely with them on the day-to-day operation. So how to clean properly, how to shift animals, building relationships with the primates, which is the most important thing. Because if you don't build a relationship with a primate or any animal that you work with, they're not going to cooperate when you need them to. So if you're asking them to go outside or to move to another cage or to take their medicine, if you don't have a relationship with them, they're not going to cooperate. When they come to us, the primates from the universities and again, the pharmaceutical companies, they're used to building relationships with the people that care for them and having good relationships. It's just we now have to move that relationship from the people or the individuals that they knew before now to us. So it does make it easier for us. So the training period can take several months. It just depends on the individual person and how the retirees are reacting to them. Sometimes they're drawn to females versus males, vice versa. Sometimes they like tall people, but not short people. All those things have to be worked through over time. So we allow them to have that time. We don't rush new caretakers in and say, you have to do this by such and such period of time or amount of time. It really is at their comfort level. And once we feel that they build those relationships, we also do have an individual that does all of our food prep for the day, all the diet preparation, make sure they get well-balanced diets, are getting a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and grains and cereals. And that is all that she does all day is just make sure that our animals have the best diet possible.
It's a tall order, caring for monkeys. It's not like caring for dogs or cats. I mean, these animals require a lot of special care. And you keep talking about relationships. Of course, the other thing that is so central to their existence is these are highly social creatures, right? They exist in social hierarchies amongst one another, and they establish those with their people as well. So all of that is very tricky. And you know, you mentioned before, you know, sometimes people don't like other people, right? The difference with monkeys is if you get a couple monkeys together who really don't care for one another or want to challenge one another for a position of dominance, I mean, they could fight to the death. So you have to really have a good understanding of how to read these animals and get a gauge on what's affiliative behavior, like, hey, I like you and I do want to hang out with you, and what could potentially become a dangerous situation. I mean, who generally keeps an eye on those things and monitors them for social compatibility?
We'll talk a little bit about how we try to introduce or pair our animals. I sum it up like this. It's like the dating game. We put them next to each other. They get to meet each other. We read their initial reaction. If they like each other, they'll give us some cues that they do want to be near one another. That could take anywhere from a couple days to a month. Generally, we feel that in a couple days, it gives us a good feel if we should move forward or if we should back off. If we move forward, then we take them to the next step where they have limited contact with touching one another. So maybe just fingers, try to groom each other through the mesh, but not actually be in together where if they did get into a fight, they could hurt each other. There's always that mesh barrier in between them. If they're giving us clues that they really don't want to be together, we would separate them and try to pair them with another animal from another portion of the sanctuary or another part of the building. The care staff are really our best resource when it comes to pairing, due to the fact that they're the ones that see them on a daily basis. So they know if one primate is maybe a little food aggressive and they may have another animal that doesn't really seem to be overly excited about their food. They eat at a much slower pace. So that may be a good combination. If you put two animals that are very focused on their food, you might have some issues when it comes to feeding time. So they observe them on a daily basis. And also as they're cleaning and they're doing enrichment and all this other things, they're watching those monkeys and they're getting an idea on how they are and what their personalities are and if they could potentially be a good pair or not.
You've mentioned the word enrichment a couple of times. Why don't you describe for our listeners what it is you provide for these animals and why enrichment is important for them?
Giving them something to occupy part of their day. Your goal is a good portion of their day. So it could be anything from playing a radio, putting a movie on that they can watch. It could be a foraging device, a toy where they have to manipulate it or twirl it or spin it to get the food out of it. It could be carrying around a little rubber toy or something that they can chew on or play with or throw. The one thing that we like to do the most is twice a day, our primates get foraging mix, a mix of plain Cheerios, pasta, sunflower seeds, dry peas. And we throw that into their enclosure. So they have to pick through the grass and the dirt and the shrubs and different things to find that stuff. And that breaks up their day.
Right. And the choice of what to use for enrichment isn't arbitrary, right? And the whole point of it is to stimulate behaviors in these animals that are natural for them. Monkeys are hugely social. You've addressed that by connecting them with other monkeys that they are compatible with so they can form a hierarchy. And then, of course, they're doing the same thing with the people there. And so that part is handled. And then what monkeys do in the wild typically is they spend most of their day foraging for food. So these foraging activities that you give them really stimulate their natural behaviors. And that's the key to happiness in an animal. These particular monkeys are arboreal. They like to climb, and you provide all of that for them. And so I don't want it to be lost on our listeners that it's not just about breaking up their day. The things you choose are chosen for a reason. And of course, your zoo background is just fantastic for all of this, right? I mean, most people would not know these things. We know it in Lab Animal because we're trained to know it because we work with all of these different kinds of animals, and we have to address those needs. But I wonder whether or not all of the other sanctuaries that exist have the same procedures. Do they address all of these needs as thoroughly as you do? As everything is carefully considered? I think that's an important question, right? So we're hearing about all of the special training these folks get. We're hearing about the enrichment that these animals get. You have a full-time kitchen person whose whole job is just to make sure they have a balanced diet that includes, you know, a mix of different varieties of food. You have laboratory animal-trained veterinarians at your disposal who are providing guidance and expertise to you, right? You also now have a new veterinary clinic. They have annual exams, and there's a lot of attention to veterinary care. I guess my question is, are you as a sanctuary required to do all of that? Or are you doing what is above and beyond what the expectations are?
I would say we're above and beyond on what the expectations are. So the USDA, they do require that you give your animals veterinarian care, but it's very cryptic. There really is no formal plan on how often you have to do it. Yes, you can't leave an animal that is injured or has a gaping wound without veterinarian care. They would have a problem with that. I don't know all the sanctuaries and all the ins and outs of how they run, but from the ones that I've seen, it seems like it's a little lacking in some ways. And I definitely am always a big advocate on trying to educate other sanctuaries on providing better veterinarian care for their primates. I think that's the right thing to do. I think we owe that to our retirees. My hope is that we can start setting some standards and some guidelines on providing good veterinarian care and good nutrition to our retirees so that other sanctuaries have something to guide them. There's always room for improvement for everybody. I don't say that we're perfect, Cindy. I would say that I'm always open to learning more and improving if we possibly can.
It doesn't sound like there are very prescriptive guidelines from the federal government about how sanctuaries actually do these things. So there's veterinary care, and then there's also the social needs that we talked about. And then there's also the dietary needs that we talked about. And so it's fascinating to hear you say that there aren't really any clear prescriptive expectations laid out that every sanctuary should follow. Because in research, when these animals are with us, every single thing you can think of is regulated. There is a direction about what we are expected to address, options for how we are to address them. They come and they make sure that we are addressing them. I mean, we are so heavily regulated and we provide for all of these needs by regulation in research settings. And yet, when you talk about sanctuaries, you know, the public, of course, they think sanctuaries, that all of them are just these, you know, heavenly places where the animals get the best care in the world. But what I'm hearing you say is that the regulatory expectations for sanctuaries are really weak, at least relative to the expectations in a research setting. Am I hearing that correctly?
I would say that. There are some organizations that accredit animal sanctuaries, but I don't think that all of their standards and guidelines are great. So right now, the bare minimum is USDA inspections and being USDA certified. The issue with that is that there are some sanctuaries that are able to scoot around even having the USDA out for an inspection. They somehow have either convinced the USDA or their inspectors that they don't need to be inspected. So some of those sanctuaries have no oversight at all. Absolutely none.
Scooting around inspections, I mean, I can't even imagine that. If you aren't available when the USDA inspector arrives unannounced and you don't allow that person to come in a research setting, you're going to get in big trouble. So I just think it's astounding that even the USDA folks on some level view sanctuaries as somehow, I don't know, like that's going to be the place where everybody gets the best care, and yet they're not overseeing them. And I think the public has a misunderstanding about that as well. I mean, and so I think this is a really important point for the public to understand. The sanctuaries really aren't heavily regulated, and that allows for a lot of variation with respect to how the animals that they retire are cared for, right? And all of that really depends on the personal knowledge then, right? The experience and expertise of the people who run them. They're not all run by a guy with decades of zoo experience, right? And so, you know, that's another problem for us in the research community. When we're going to retire an animal, we have to find the right people because we know not every sanctuary is the same. We know this. The public doesn't know that. And, you know, they're giving all their money to these different sanctuaries. And some of them, frankly, aren't caring for their animals properly at all. Or the people who care for these animals, right? I mean, so for example, these monkeys that we're talking about, macaques, carry a very deadly virus called B virus. And it's not deadly to them. It's a herpes virus. It doesn't really affect them, but they pass it around like crazy. The problem is if we get it from them, there's an 80% chance that we'll die, right? So, and these folks don't all know about that, nor do they protect their staff appropriately. Now you do. I mean, I've seen your folks interact with them. They're trained in monkey behavior. They wear the appropriate protective clothing to make sure that they stay safe and that they can maintain these really valuable relationships with their animals. But again, I think the really important takeaway message here is that all sanctuaries are not created equal, and there isn't any regulatory expectation for them to provide the care that, frankly, they were getting when they were in research. So again, like I said, I've been to your place a couple times and I'm just crazy about your place. If you know monkeys and you see monkeys, you know when they are having all of their needs addressed and when they're not. And your monkeys are just over the moon satisfied with things. They have great affiliations with their partners. They're curious about the people who come to see them. And all of those things are very telling because monkeys can be coy or overly aggressive and feel challenged. And your monkeys are not like that at all. They're very relaxed around people. And I think you've done just an amazing job acclimating them. And they seem to really enjoy the space they're in. And they have a lot of activities and options. I mean, it makes me really, really happy because that's my favorite animal in the whole world. I have a couple of favorites over there and you know who they are, right? I mean, my favorite baboon is Jerry. I have a total crush on him. I love Jerry. He sent me a painting, by the way. And I have it and it's here on my wall, along with a picture of his gorgeous face. So you do have some animals that have come from the pet trade, but you have a large amount of animals have come from research. Have you noticed a difference in the behaviors of the animals that you get from research institutions relative to those you get from the pet trade?
Definitely, we see a difference in their personalities, their mannerisms, their behaviors, all those things. Primates that come from the pet trade are usually bonded to one or two people, the people that have had them, pretty hard. So it can be a hard adjustment for them. They're in a new environment and they're meeting people that they don't know. Most of them have never even been around another primate of their own kind. So to see another primate, to hear the noises that they make and all the interaction that primates do with one another can be shocking to them. The other issue that we run into with primates that come from the pet trade is diet. They generally have a horrible, horrible diet when they come to the sanctuary. They're not being fed properly. They're being given pizza or candy or soda or chips and things like that. So to give them fruits and vegetables or a balanced monkey chow biscuit is really alien to them. Some of them have abnormal behaviors, doing backflips, standing on their head, clapping their hands. It could be anything that the primate generally did to get somebody's attention. It's all a learned behavior. So when they come to the sanctuary, we have to remind the staff constantly to not acknowledge those behaviors. They will eventually go away. From the research side of it, I would say much better adjusted than the primates that come out of the pet trade, maybe over-grooming themselves or maybe have a little bald spot on them. Once they get into an environment where they can go outside and they have their own kind to socialize with, to groom, those behaviors will go away relatively quickly. Generally, animals that come to us from a university have a very well-balanced diet. So just to transition them to what we feed and how we feed, very easy. I would say they acclimate much quicker.
You've set yourself up to take in larger quantities of these animals than others. How much land do you have and how much are you currently using?
So we have 80 acres of property. We're probably on about 15 to 20 currently.
Okay, 75% of the space you have, you could build out, right? Now, let me tell you why I think this is interesting. PETA and others are constantly petitioning Congress and the NIH to stop doing research with monkeys and take them all right now and put them in sanctuaries. And currently, there are tens of thousands of monkeys in research. So I guess my question is, if money was not an issue, would you be able to retire all of the monkeys in research at your facility right now?
With our current property, we probably could expand to maybe 250, 300 at the most if we design everything and lay things out in the best possible way. There is no way that any sanctuary would be able to absorb that many primates at any time or even long term.
What about if all of the sanctuaries that have experience with these kinds of animals came together? Could all of them combined house all of the monkeys in research?
No, I don't think that's even possible. So it's just not sanctuaries taking primates from universities and pharmaceutical companies. It's taking them from the pet trade and also from the roadside zoos. We're just inundated. And most, if not all, sanctuaries are at their maximum.
Yeah. I mean, so this is just an unrealistic expectation. And these groups continue to request donations from the public so that they can drive this point home and get all these monkeys retired. And what I'm hearing you say is it's impossible. And you, of course, have a very strong relationship and are connected to all of the sanctuaries that work with monkeys, right? It's a small world. I think that's important for the public to understand. Even if there was enough space for them, right? The thing we already talked about is that they don't all have the right expertise. They're not all doing this as well as they should. And so would these animals get the best care? Would they get the care they're getting currently in research settings at all of these other sanctuaries? Let's move on to the money part. These animals are very expensive to maintain. So when we in research are looking for a place to retire our animals, one of the things we always have to think about also is, you know, what's their business plan? Are they going to be able to take care of them for the rest of their lives? Monkeys can live 20 to 30 years, right? You know, so how are they getting funding? And now, in my experience, this is very tricky for us because all of the sanctuaries I know of, except two, use negative messaging, right? Basically, they demonize research and they talk about the horrible condition these animals are in when they get them as a way to solicit money from a public who loves animals. Now, that's something you do not do. You very deliberately maintain neutral messaging. And so you're probably losing out on a good chunk of money, right? You know, tell me why that's important for you. I mean, you could do the same thing. Why do you maintain this position of neutral messaging when it comes to research animals in your sanctuary?
We want to make sure that we retain good relationships with all the universities and pharmaceutical companies. They do love their primates. That should never, ever be a question. We know for a fact. I've seen it. I've met everybody involved with the care of these primates. They really do love them and they want the best for them. And if they're able to be retired at the end of their studies, they're going to do it. And we want to be involved in that, building relationships with them. So we've always sat on the fence. We don't say we're for research. We don't say that we're against research. We want them to feel comfortable that they can have a good relationship with us and move forward. We always say that when somebody retires a primate to us, they become part of our family. They always check on their retirees. They want to see updates. They want to see pictures. They call me, they email me wondering how they're doing. I give them updates on who they're paired with or a fun story, something that they did that I think they would get a good laugh out of. They become part of our family, and that will continue to be our mission forever.
How do you raise the funds to do this? Because you're not going to get any money from the government for it because they don't provide it. I have a real problem with this. These are not things, they're animals. When you give a researcher federal funds to do studies with animals, you need to account for the fact that those animals, if they don't have to be euthanized, will need to be cared for after. If you don't provide funding for that, especially expensive animals like this, then sometimes institutions don't have any choice but to euthanize animals. And I think that's a fundamental flaw in the system. There must be, starting immediately, I feel, some earmarked funding for post-study care for animals during retirement. That has to happen. If that happens, it'll be easier for people like you to continue to build your sanctuary up and care for these animals properly. But the money's got to come from somewhere. How much does it cost a year to care for a monkey on average?
So we say our yearly cost per primate is between $5,000 and $5,500 a year. But that's relatively low. And the reason that we can do that is because of the relationships that we have built with the facilities that are retiring animals with us. We generally get a lot of our monkey chow, a lot of our fruits and vegetables donated to the sanctuary. So we're not buying those things. All of our veterinarian care is all donated to the sanctuary. We don't pay anything for veterinarian care. Medical supplies, we have pharmaceutical companies sending us all of our PPE equipment, so gloves and face masks and hair nets and boot covers and lab coats, all of that stuff is free. It all has to do with building relationships, even with the community, grocery stores and farmers, people that have different materials to donate to the sanctuary. It's about building relationships with everybody. It's all for the benefit of the retirees. So why not do it?
In the journal Science, your sanctuary was featured along with some representatives from Yale and Princeton because they have actually decided to retire monkeys at your sanctuary for life. And they made a significant investment in order to be able to do that. Describe for us what the arrangement is and how all that came to be.
Yale and Princeton were the first ones that really truly believed in our business plan and our concept for the sanctuary and long-term goals of the sanctuary. They wanted to make sure that they had a place at the sanctuary long-term where they could retire the first retirees, but also make a place where they could send additional retirees down the road. So we came up with a pretty innovative plan, which consisted of Yale and Princeton funding construction at the sanctuary for the building that they have. That building always belongs to Yale and Princeton, and then they can retire their animals as they need to. So this agreement will go on as long as Princeton and Yale need us to do that. It's a great idea for retirement for individual universities that want to make sure that they have a long-term plan for future retirees.
Do they continue to provide yearly funding for these animals?
They made an initial investment for the building and for the long-term care for their retirees. That money they donated was put into our endowment fund, which earns interest and value, and we pull off of that endowment to fund future retirement for their primates.
Do you have any other research institutions communicating with you? And you don't have to identify them.
So as of now, we have worked with over 12 individual facilities for retirement and building construction. And in the works, we already have 3 to 4 others that are in the discussion phase of building a building and also doing the long-term care for future retirees. And there are many, many more that want to do this. They want to make the commitment for retirement. It's the right thing to do.
And I think that's fantastic. And I agree. Before we close, do you have anything else you want to share with our listeners?
For facilities that are looking to retire animals, keep an open mind when it comes to a discussion about retirement. Make sure you do your due diligence. Make a visit to the sanctuary. Ask for policies and procedures. Talk to their veterinarian. Look at their financial plans to make sure that they're going to be around for as long as you need them to be around. These animals just aren't there for a year or two. Like you said earlier, it could be 20 years. It could be 25 years. If the sanctuary does not have enough money or resources to care for the primates that you retired there, then you've done them no justice. From the people's side of it, the general public, I would say support the sanctuaries that need the help to care for these primates that need retirement and deserve retirement. Make sure you do your research on who you're supporting. Look at what they believe and what their standards are, what their mission is, what their goals are. Make sure that you look at every aspect of that organization.
Right. I mean, the litmus test is, are they doing this for the well-being of the monkeys, or are they doing what they're doing to support an alternative agenda? You know, these monkeys mean everything to me. I mean, all of the animals in research do, but I have a really, really strong passion for monkeys because of my own personal experiences. And so I just love everything you're doing for our monkeys. And I'm so grateful to you, and I love you. And I just want to thank you again for coming on and sharing all of that with us and our listeners.
Thank you so much. It really has been wonderful. And thank you again for giving me the opportunity to talk a little bit more about these wonderful beings.
It's clear from our discussion today that all animal sanctuaries are not created equal. It also seems clear that regulatory expectations and oversight for these sanctuaries are questionable at best. The consequences of these failures have already led to a tremendous amount of animal suffering. I'll post some examples on the episode response page of our website for you to review for yourselves. So why is everyone, including our legislators, so enamored with the idea of putting our animals in these places? When are we going to stop being puppets for PETA, HSUS, White Coat Waste, and others with the same self-serving agenda and actually do our own homework on these places? And when are we going to hold the animal rights profiteers, and the government for that matter, accountable for how they spend our money? Research animals lose so much for us. They deserve well-funded options for responsible care when they can be retired. Send me your thoughts at getrealpodcast.info, and I'll post them on our social media pages for discussion. And while you're there, please click on the support link and commit to a small monthly donation. We still have so much to talk about, and I really appreciate your engagement. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real. Thanks for joining us today. Up next, are animal rights good for animal welfare? Find out on the next episode of Get Real. We'll talk soon.